Well, now let's bring in Andrew Bacevich, Boston University professor, retired Army colonel, Vietnam vet, who was an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq long before his son, an Army lieutenant, was killed in that war. Andrew's new book is a scathing critique of the new volunteer military, in which he says Americans give up any responsibility for war, handing it fully over to Washington, which happily accepts. Bacevich says following Vietnam and the end of the draft, all it takes to invade a country is concurrence among a half dozen people and a nod from the president. No need to get congressional assent. No need to consult the American people, who, he says, are not innocent in this. Americans, he says, applaud troops at baseball games and convince themselves that qualifies as citizenship. Professor Bacevich's new book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. He joins us in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So here we have President Obama making this surprise pivot. He will ask Congress to vote. He said he heard the voices of Americans and their concern. You say what?
Well, it certainly surprised me as much as it did everybody else, but I think that the president's being disingenuous when he says that he's responding to the people's concerns. I think the reality is that he painted himself into a corner with his ill-advised comment about Syrian use of chemical weapons constituting some sort of red line. Mm. So what the president's doing, I think, is basically saying to the Congress, why don't you share in the responsibility for this decision?
Which is one of the biggest criticisms of your book, which is that Americans, by and large, don't share in responsibility of any decision.
Let me be clear. I was surprised by what the president did, and I emphatically applaud it. The president, whether intentionally or not, has set an important precedent here.
Well, put aside the debate over whether or not the U.S. should respond. Put that aside for a second. Just the idea of how the U.S. goes about enacting policy now, because you draw it all back to the U.S. military getting rid of the draft after Vietnam. Let's set the scene as you do. You open your book in Fenway Park, 4th of July, 2011. The Red Sox announcer welcomes the family of a young U.S. sailor. Her name is Bridget Lydon. She's serving on the USS Ronald Reagan, supporting the war in Afghanistan. Huge American flag on the big green monster. That's the wall here at Fenway Park where the Red Sox play. Bridget appears on a video screen. She greets her family. Let's listen.
I wish I could be there, but I want to wish you all a happy 4th of July.
Well, and what happens then? She actually walks out from that door by the scoreboard, by the green monster, and her family runs across the field, and the Red Sox fans in the stands go wild applauding her. You say what?
I think this is an example of what Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian and martyr, famously called cheap grace, gestures that make ourselves feel good and kind of become an excuse to avoid grappling with important moral issues. This feel-good moment symbolizing an ostensible unity between people and military quickly passes and I think becomes an excuse not to appreciate the extent to which there is in fact a great gap between the military and society and that the testimonials of affection and support for the troops are in a very fundamental sense dishonest and fraudulent.
What's the danger of that?
As Americans forfeit personal direct responsibility for contributing to the country's defense, abandoning the tradition of the citizen soldier, then the state gains ownership of the military. The army becomes Washington's army, not our army. And Washington has demonstrated a penchant for using the army recklessly. If we were sitting here and we could look back on the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War and see them as victory, economically achieved, advancing the security interests and the well-being of our people, the Iraq and the Afghanistan people, I would be the first one to say that the professional military that we created after Vietnam is a great success. But that's not the case.
Let's talk about how it affects the military, how the military evolved when the draft was eliminated. It embraced technology, this idea of a fleeter force, also the embrace of women, gays, blacks. Isn't that evolution, you just kind of sort of hinted at your answer when you talked about how Iraq and Afghanistan went, but on the face of it, you would think, wow, that seems like a good idea, more egalitarian and relying more on technology and a fleeter force rather than boots on the ground.
No question about it. This is an argument from our present vantage point. If we had had this conversation back in 1992 when I got out of the Army and you asked me to evaluate the all-volunteer force, I myself at that point would have said, hey, it's working, meaning that the cultural divide between the military and society that was acutely apparent back in the Vietnam War was closed in the wake of the Vietnam War.
And by the way, when you say acutely apparent, it's soldiers killing each other. I mean, coupled with a war that many didn't understand, the war in Vietnam, you had whites against blacks, you
Absolutely.
Had dopers against drinkers.
Right.
You know,
So that reform effort manifestly accomplished good things in the arena of culture. Now, you mentioned the word technology and the role of technology in warfare. Well, the generals after Vietnam, and in particular after Operation Desert Storm in 1991, I think quite foolishly, came to believe that technology held the secret to future victories. Victory is assured. And it was this utopian expectation of what war could achieve that then helped lay the basis for thinking that a global war on terrorism after 9/11 would be a good idea. That judgment by the senior military leadership turned out to be wrong. But here we are in 2013. We really ought to consider the possibility that maybe basic U.S. military policy is fundamentally flawed. I think the greatest defect is this disengagement of the people from the military.
And that the people, citizen soldiers, for instance, might be more likely to sound an alarm. We're going to hear what Andrew suggests to bring back some form of citizen soldier, his new book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. It's not published till September 10th. We hear it's going to get reviewed by Rachel Maddow this Sunday in the New York Times, but you can get a sneak peek at hereandnow.org. We'll have more with Andrew in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and we're back with our conversation with Andrew Basevich, Boston University professor, retired Army colonel, and Vietnam vet. His son, Army First Lieutenant Andrew Basevich Jr., killed in Iraq in 2007. And long before that, the father was scrutinizing the military. In his new book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, he says the gap between citizens and soldiers caused by ending the draft is bad for both, that citizens' voices are imperative to raise questions before war and on the battlefield. And Andrew, pick up where we left. A professional army relying on corporate contractors, which seemed like a good idea, but you write, the army might have saved money, but it lost self-sufficiency, that wars are longer now, not more efficient.
The generals argued that we may be getting a little bit smaller, but we can actually do more because technology increases our capabilities. And there was this expectation that we would win, win quickly, win easily, win decisively. When victory turned out to be, frankly, beyond reach in Iraq and Afghanistan, how does Washington respond? It responds by opening the door to private defense contractors with, I think, very negative consequences, not least of all, negative consequences for the military profession itself, which defines its reason for existing, that the military professionals provide something unique, special, and necessary to the conduct of war. Now, you don't need to do that. You can just sort of farm out these responsibilities to people who are looking to turn a buck.
You dedicate your book to two soldiers, Captain William Reichardt and Captain Theodore West Husing. Reichardt killed by his own men in Vietnam. We talked about how the citizen soldiers, you know, almost turned on themselves when a war wasn't going well, which, as horrible as that was, at least that was a, you know, an alarm, you know, being sent out. But I want you to talk about West Husing. We reported on this. He took his life in 2005 after trying to blow the whistle on his beloved Army's partnership with defense contractors. You write, an indelible stain, and he just couldn't live with it. You say his was a sacrificial act, his committing suicide, and attention must be paid by anyone concerned about the health of the military. You know, here we have someone, you're not the only one who's said this, that he took his life because he just couldn't bear to see what this contract of the American military with contractors was doing to the Army. What more was it doing that he saw?
It was corrupting the military. I mean, Colonel West Husing, who I never met, was, I think, by all accounts, a remarkable man. West Point graduate, graduated very high in his class, and chose to leave the field army and return to West Point to teach as part of the permanent faculty, got a PhD in philosophy, where the subject of his dissertation was military honor. So this is somebody for whom honor was central to his being. And he volunteered to leave West Point to go on a tour to Iraq, and perhaps tragically, or certainly ironically, instead of being sent to a U.S. combat unit, he was assigned to a job in which he was supposed to supervise one of these contracts. And the contractor, at least the accusations were that the contractor was corrupt. And when this was brought to his attention, West Husing felt personally responsible, personally stained, and for whatever reason, we can't understand the reason, couldn't cope with that and took his own life. I think this should have been seen by the senior military leadership as the fire bell in the night, that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way we have organized our military, given the kinds of wars in which we have found ourselves. Now, there's a choice here. The choice is, don't go fight those wars. Let us not pursue Washington's vision of being able to somehow control the course of events in the Middle East by the adroit use of American military power. Or if indeed we are going to persist in trying to use force to have our way in the Middle East, then we need a different army. Hmm. We need a bigger army. I think that's a fundamental choice that, frankly, people in Washington don't want to confront.
Well, a couple of things, Andrew Bacevich. Are you saying that if we restored the draft and it was a citizen's army, they would rise up sooner and not allow corrupt contractors, not allow foolish expectations of war? What are you saying? Iraq might not have happened if we had a citizen's army? They would have protested before it even started?
My proposal, to be clear, is not to restore the draft, but to enact a program of national service. National service means all able-bodied young people owe a couple of years of service to the country. Some of them may choose to serve in the military. All the rest will serve in other capacities, you know, whether it's a renewed equivalent of the Civilian Conservation Corps
or
whatever.
So what
would that do? To my mind, it would revive the concept of a citizen soldier, and I think we would have the people once again more closely engaged in decisions as to where that army goes and what it is sent to do. And at worst, if we found ourselves in another Iraq war, we would then have a mechanism to expand the army. We could make the army bigger without having to turn things over to these defense contractors and all the negative baggage that comes with taking that approach to waging a war.
You say that it's not just about how we wage war, but how we live that changed when we got rid of a citizen's army. Let me read you. It's page 41 here. Apathy towards war is symptomatic of advancing civic decay, finding expression in apathy toward the blight of child poverty, homelessness, illegitimacy, eating disorders. Shrugging off wars makes it that much easier for Americans, overweight, overmedicated, and deeply in hock, to shrug off the persistence of widespread hunger. You go on and on. You say, we're not as good citizens.
Well, I think that to revive the tradition of the citizen soldier can become maybe I'm being too optimistic here, but can become the vehicle, in a sense, for reviving a more robust sense of what it means to be a citizen, and that we will become less selfish, less self-absorbed, and more concerned with the well-being of our neighbors and of the community more broadly.
Hmm. Andrew Bacevich, one last question. You address the death of your own son in the war in Iraq just once, and it's kind of sideways. It's on page 135 here. You say, after the war in Iraq, Americans might ponder the question of what the loss of several thousand soldiers there signifies. I have grappled with that question myself, not altogether successfully. That's it. Was the death of your son underscoring all of this, or?
Well, you know, this is not something that I prefer to talk about.
Exactly.
But how can it not be? You know, for all of us, things happen in our lives that leave a permanent mark, and we are different as a consequence of that experience. And I'm sure that's the case with me.
Andrew Bacevich, his new book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. It's published September 10th. Line up to get it. It's a terrific read. Andrew, thanks as always.
Thank you.
So your thoughts? Only 1% of Americans serve, Andrew Bacevich says. This disconnect also, between Americans and the military led to the economic collapse. George W. Bush told Americans to go shopping, go to Disneyland, instead of sacrificing maybe paying a war tax. Americans were happy to do that. You have second thoughts about that? Or on any of this, let us know at hereandnow.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to improving memory and attention with neuroscience-based games for the brain at Lumosity.com. And Olin College of Engineering, working to educate the next generation of engineering innovators to solve the world's complex technical challenges, olin.edu.